Father James Hayes, the present pastor of the Shrine of the Little Flower, has asked me, Father Gargan, to say a few words about the beginnings of this magnificent Shrine of the Little Flower. These are some of the facts not generally known. Prior to my coming to the Shrine of the Little Flower, I was the administrator of a parish in Lapeer County. That's two counties north of here. At a little town called North Branch. So it so happened that Bishop Gallagher, my revered friend and patron, invited me to leave North Branch, come to Detroit, and originate a parish somewhere on Woodward Avenue. That was quite a shock to me to find that my bishop had so much reliance on my ability to start a new parish. And when he informed me that I should go to North Woodward Avenue, I found this likely spot here at the crossroads of metropolitan Detroit. Because all the prominent personages in the Michigan Gulf Telephone, Detroit Edison, Consolidated Gas, and government all said that this probably would be the center of the new metropolitan area, Woodward at 12 Mile Road. Thus it was in 1926, probably towards the end of January or the beginning of February, that I began searching for a plot, and this is it. To begin with, I wasn't too clever in discerning the number of potential parishioners that I would have should I build a church here. But nevertheless, Bishop Gallagher says, here's $58,000 for you with which to purchase property and to build a modest little church. I organized a committee of persons, lay people. I found out that I had four non-Catholics on the original church committee and four Catholics. Altogether, there were only 28 Catholic families in the territory allotted to me, and 13 of them were mixed marriages. The four non-Catholic church committeemen to begin with came from one of these 13 mixed marriage families. So the church was built just where the tower stands, not back where the original little church finally came to grief. In front of the church, less than 100 feet, thundered the Grand Trunk Railroad. And this railroad was there for 3 or 4 years, probably, before its last rusty tracks were removed. Meanwhile, a fiery cross had been planted outside the little finished chapel, and this fiery cross did more than amuse me, I'm telling you, because it was a threat from the Ku Klux Klan, as it was called in those days, that I was not welcome in this territory. I do remember, when this cross was put up, that I ventured to say to some of the bystanders and parishioners that one day there will be a cross on this corner which neither the Ku Klux Klan nor any other organization will be able to tear down. And it was then, probably after some thought and consideration, June of that year, I began making plans for a permanent church. That year, 1926, will always be memorable, one of the dearest years in my life, because nothing but bankruptcy stared me in the face. How could these 28 families support this church, pay off the $58,000 when a dollar was a real dollar, not such as it is today? How could they ever do such a thing? Well, I don't know how they accomplished it, but it so happened that I had many good friends in Detroit. Among others, George Richards, the owner of Station WJR at that time, Mr. Stevenson, after whom the Stevenson Highway was named, the great man who built $2,700 homes in Clawson and Hazel Park for those persons who had been brought here to work in the factories, Mr. Frederick Fisher, the head of the seven brother Fisher family, Fisher Body, General Motors. He was my friend, as was his wife, dear Sally. And another one I must mention, Senator James Cousins, whose wife was an ardent Catholic, and he himself had some fondness for me that I cannot explain. But those gentlemen encouraged me to go ahead, as well as another wonderful personage, a man whom the baseball world will always remember as Aloysius Egan, the great Wish Egan, who worked with Mr. Navin in building up the Detroit Tigers, who worked with Mr. Navin in collecting young players from all over America. So one day, Mr. Egan, a spokesman for those other gentlemen whom I mentioned, came to me and said, "Listen, Father Charles, don't worry about the dollars to pay off for this church. I think I have a plan." He says, "You have an admirer, you know, thanks to me and to several others on the Tigers, an admirer by the name of Babe Ruth." He says, "I know what you're going to do. I know how we'll get money to pay this debt. A week from next Friday, Babe will be in town with the New York Yankees. And Babe will do anything for you that I ask him. And you know what I'm going to ask him to do? Come out and be the usher with the rest of the Yankees and the Tigers at the Shrine of the Little Flower. And if we can't get it on the front page of the Detroit papers, we'll get it on the sport pages, and that will be better." So the Sunday came around, and the poor priest at 12 Mile Road and Woodward Avenue, who didn't know where he was getting the next money to pay off the monthly payment on his parish that was just a born, saw in the papers that his church was to be taken over by the New York Yankees and the Detroit Tigers on a Sunday in June or July, thanks to Wish Egan. Well, you can imagine what happened. The sports page carried it, carried my picture on the sports page, carried it with Babe Ruth and all those wonderful players. And here they were at the four doors of a little shingled church that was built here where the cross now stands. The redoubtable Babe was at one side, Wish Egan was at another side, and as all the thousands of persons poured into the church, they were ushered right through one door, out the other, and they couldn't pass without putting some green money in the hats of these Yankees and Tigers. And thus it happened that over $10,000 was collected by Babe Ruth, who told everybody, "We don't know how to change money, keep on moving." And they put it in the bank for me the next day. Well, that's how the little parish got started.
And it became news all over. To have Babe Ruth as usher in your church. I said, Babe, you're the greatest thief I ever met in my life. You don't know how to change $5 bills. Perhaps they didn't teach you how when you went to school. Because every bill that fell in there, you saw that I got with no change given to the donor. So, that's the beginning of this tower. That's the beginning of the boast that was made. Yes, they'll burn this down with their fiery cross, but they'll see a day when a cross will go up here that they'll never burn down. And that day is now because others inside the church and outside the church are trying to get rid of Jesus Christ, the Superman, as they call him, not Jesus Christ, the God. That's the beginning of this visit of yours to the shrine to let you know how it got started. Michael Gallagher had the dream. I was perhaps the instrumentality of his dream, but the great Wishegan, the great Fred Fisher, the great Jim Cousins, the great B.F. Stevenson, and my friends on the Yankees and the Tigers started the church off, and it was wonderful. But do you know that church of the little flower, the Shingle Church, had the misfortune of being burnt to the ground 2 years later on the 17th of March. St. Patrick certainly wasn't good to me, so I thought. And St. Patrick had done something that I couldn't understand. But there was my friend, Madeline Goodrich. Madeline was a stenographer in a large concern down Woodward Avenue. She was the one who said, Father, don't you remember what you said when Babe Ruth was mocking the people of all their greenbacks? More than 10,000 of them had passed through the church that day in a church built to accommodate a parishioner of 28 families. Well, what is it, Madeline, I said. And she said you'd build a cross that they couldn't tear down. I challenge you to go ahead and do it. Well, the challenge stood. And we started then to lay plans for this crucifixion tower out in front. Sure, everybody calls this the Shrine of the Little Flower. It is. It was the first church in all the world that was dedicated to this little saint. And how about that? Well, I'll tell you how. Bishop Gallagher of Detroit and Bishop Schrems, then of Cleveland, Ohio, were two intimate friends of one of the greatest popes who ever sat upon the throne of Peter. I mean Pius XI. And they visited Pius XI frequently. And it so happened that Pius XI had on his desk when he was the librarian at Milan the picture of a little girl. A little girl, 13 years of age. And one day when Michael Gallagher and Joseph Schrems, the two bishops, had been visiting him at Milan before he was pope, said, who's the little girl there? And he said, oh, that's a little favorite of mine. She said, her name is Teresa Martin. And we called her the little flower. She's dead. Of course, she died in 1897. She was only 24 years old, and nobody knows much about her except myself and a few friends up here at Milan whom I'm preaching to all the time about her. Well, what's this got to do? Oh, this has to do very much. And these men, these two bishops, kept that in mind all these years when finally their friend became the great Pius XI. So this day that I'm talking about found the two bishops again visiting Pope Pius XI. And here they were, the two of them and another American priest from Pittsburgh by the name of Barry O'Toole. Perhaps the Pittsburgh people forget about him. Perhaps the great cardinal from Pittsburgh, Cardinal John Wright, forgets about Barry. But Barry was a professor there and a great librarian, as was Pius XI. And here these men gathered in Pope Pius' private sitting room. The month was the 1st of May. The date was 1926. And they were discussing a little girl whose picture was still on the desk of the Pope, little Teresa Martin. And Pius XI, leaning over to the two bishops, says, "I have a secret to tell you. We're going to canonize her yet this month." Well, here I was, about to start the church. Here I was, about to give it a name. And Bishop Gallagher, the next day, was on the telephone in Rome, phoning to me, and he says, "Father Charles, I have a name for your new parish. It's going to be the Shrine of the Little Flower." And I said, "Who is she?" And he says, "Why, you wouldn't know. She's the new saint that's coming up this month. She's the great friend of Pius XI." I wanted to tell you that much because this is a part of history that doesn't find itself in the books. Or I could go on preaching about this to you or informing you of this little bit anecdote by anecdote. But that night when they were in there visiting Pius, he says, "Gentlemen, you know, I'm a thief." This is the Pope calling himself a thief. He says, "Gentlemen, I'm a thief. Do you know what I did after I was elevated to the papacy? I sent a Monsignor over to Lisieux and told him to capture the dress that the little flower wore when she entered Carmel." Every little girl that enters Carmel is a nun, you know, has a wedding dress. So he went over there and found this beautiful wedding dress that her mother had not made for her, but had supplied for her with the most precious, precious lace that she knew how to make. She was the great lace maker of France, of course. And there it was, this precious dress, and the Monsignor took it out of the cupboard, and I visited the very cupboard where the dress used to be, and he brought it back to the Vatican, and Pius XI had his tailors make it into a chasuble. And he says to the two bishops, he says, "Brothers, I'm saying Mass in this dress tomorrow with this chasuble on, and you'll be there, and you can say Mass after me on the same altar, and each one of you can wear this dress, wear this chasuble." Isn't that a peculiar story? That you gentlemen, you ladies, you priests, lay people, learn from an old priest, now 82 years old, passing this earth information on to you. Well, I named it May the 17th. She was canonized. It was the first church in all the world dedicated to her because maybe somebody found out here before anybody else in America what was about to happen to the little flower. Well, why this little flower? You know, she was only 24 years old when she died. She was only a little girl, 13, when she had first gone to Leo XIII and asked him permission to get into the Carmel. And he says, "My darling, you're too young. You'll have to wait for a while and get your bishop's permission." Only 13 years of age. Leo XIII, you know, the great pope, issued the greatest encyclicals ever written, probably. One Humanum Genus, H-U-M-A-N-U-M, capital J-G-E-N-U-S, which means the human race. It was the encyclical which told about the new cult of naturalism, The new cult of you don't need a saviorism. The new cult of man can get along by himselfism. Leo XIII, 1886, wrote that. No one paid attention to it. And again in 1891, he wrote another letter, an encyclical, we call it. And he said, listen, ladies and gentlemen of the Catholic world, listen, bishops and priests of the Catholic world, there's a new movement on in the world after the Industrial Revolution, and it's given out by a young man named Marx. And this young man named Marx will revolutionize this world if you bishops and priests and laity don't get busy and help the laboring man who's been enslaved as a result of the industrialism and the new machinery. Hardly anybody ever paid attention to Leo XIII. His was the greatest voice crying in the wilderness since the days of John the Baptist and Jesus Christ. Leo XIII's voice. Never was there a voice that cried in the wilderness, and the Catholic world paid little or no heed to him. Well, what about the little flower of man, Leo XIII? Well, Leo XIII was the Pope who told her, go home and wait. Pius XI was the Pope coming up who told her, after she died, you're the great inspirer of my papacy. There is very words, the inspirer of my papacy. And he told the people of the Catholic world, do what Leo XIII told you to do 40 years ago. So here I am then, following the command Pius XI and Leo XIII, probably Leo XIII was the most intelligent and one of the most saintly popes that ever reigned. And Pius XI, one of the most fearless popes that ever reigned. Because there he was standing off against all the naturalists, all the potentates of empire, monarchy, republicanism, democracies, and the forthcoming communism, saying that your naturalism can't work, saying that your religions that don't believe in the grace of God can't work. There he is saying, come, listen to my little flower. Well, I have a lot more to tell you about that, but I'm just going to say a few words about the little flower, and at another occasion, I will tell you things about her. I want you to know that the little flower is the patroness of the youth movement in the world today. I want you to know, it's interesting to note that in 1928, during the anti-Catholic and anti-clerical persecution, the little flower was made patroness of Mexico by Pius XI. I want you to know that the patroness of the Lateran Treaty, by which the Vatican State was given sovereignty, along with the sovereignty of Italy, I want you to know that she was made the patroness of the Vatican State, where the Pope lives today, where the cardinals live, where the bishops go, to have Vatican III someday to undo the damage of Vatican II that was made up by those other bishops who came home, those other priests who came home, and by the naturalists who came home and wouldn't follow out what was dictated by Pius XI and Leo XIII. They'll go to the place where the patroness is the little flower of Lisieux, over the whole Vatican State. I'll recount again the words of Pius XI. She is the star of my pontificate and will remain so as long as the papacy is here. Great state, isn't she? Did you ever hear of a little girl being elevated so high by any pope? And another thing about America, she was made the patroness of the new state of Alaska, the largest state in the Union. She's been made the patroness of the young Christian workers of the world. She's been made the patroness of France, co-equal with Joan of Arc by Pius XII, as he called her to do something about this devastation of civilization. And 2 weeks later, after she was made the patroness of France, came D-Day. Well, I suppose she's doing her business in heaven, doing good on earth. As a matter of fact, she's the only saint I know of in all the history of the saints who was willing to spend her heaven not before the throne of God in heaven, but dwelling on earth to do good on earth until the apocalypse will have been fulfilled. And that is the first little intimation that I'll give you of why the Shrine of the Little Flower came in. I'm only a poor weak instrument. I didn't even know who Teresa Martin was when Michael Gallagher phoned to me from Rome that you'll call your church by that name. I didn't even know that she was one of 9 children in a day when they didn't know the meaning of abortion. I didn't even know that there was going to be a youth rebellion for these 2 uncivilized, barbarian wars that we had known as World War I and World War II, and for the 3rd barbarian war that's now over. Yes, 3rd World War has been fought, and we have lost it again. It was fought in Korea. It was fought in Vietnam. It was fought in Cambodia. It was fought in Laos. It's lost. And we've lost the respect of the world. We've lost the respect for religion, for authority, as the country today is divided and the youth is in rebellion with leaderless ecclesiastics who are urging them on to be rebels, like the French revolutionary people were rebels, but not rebels for Jesus Christ, not rebels carrying the sword and the implementation of the gospel of Christ, as told by St. Paul in his epistles. Put ye on the sword of truth and of charity. Yes, the youth has to be saved. And this tower here, that they won't burn down in a hurry, long after I'm gone, they'll try to do away with it. And there was even a movement on among some anti-Christian people in this county to have me take down that corpus from the cross because it was offensive to certain people. It will come down when Christ will have been forgotten in this world. And I appeal to you who heard this message to go out, get behind the youth, teach the youth that there is a liberation for women if they'll follow the prayerful way of the little flower. Teach the way to the youth to rebel against all war that wins nothing but devastation. Teach the way of the youth that the great young crusader called Jesus Christ our Savior, who was only 33 years old, established around himself another group of youthful young men called apostles. None of them over 33. All of them under 33. Probably John the youngest, 18. That was a youth rebellion. And we need another youth rebellion today under the patronage of the little flower, under the obedience of the successor of Pius XII and 11th and Leo the 13th, who first called for that thing with their encyclicals, that have been neglected and have been substituted for other. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to Caesar the things that are God's. Put Caesar where he belongs.